Hey, Rory.
Hi, Steph. How are you?
I'm well. How are you going?
Good, thanks.
Good. How are you finding Sydney?
I really like Sydney. I lived here for 4 years, and then I secured a wife over here as well.
Oh, good.
And so she lives. She's back in Perth, but
Any tips?
I like it.
What's it? Any tips?
For how to secure a wife?
Mm. Not for me, but
being really ridiculously good looking. I think that was the first point at which I gathered her attention, and then yeah.
So you have a wife.
I do.
Yes. Do you have kids or
anything? Yeah, 4 kids, all boys, 7 and under.
Mm, cool. Yep. And so, Rory, I think this tells a lot about a person. Do you have any hobbies? Distrust immediately.
I think there's a whole lot of things that I feel happy to speak about with little to no knowledge or authority. So if that's a hobby, then I'm really into architecture and gardening and soil science.
Soil science? That's a thing?
Yeah, it is a thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
I
read half a thing on it once, but I've been talking to people about it at dinner parties ever since.
I once read a book about how to talk about books you've never read before.
Yeah, okay.
Which is kind of ironic. Anyway, so can you also tell us what's on your bucket list? You know, something like things you want to do before you die.
Okay, so I think the major one on my bucket list, like my 19-year-old self wouldn't believe this, but my 37-year-old self really wants to go to the United States of America. Like, I'm totally up for that. And I would like to get into Boston and then kind of hitchhike / kind of make my way from the northeast right through to Louisiana and come out at New Orleans.
Yep.
And then I would kind of write a Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan-style album about my experiences.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing the fruit of that endeavor.
Sure. It'll happen.
So I presume you're a Christian. Can you tell us how that came to be?
It came to be because in the, I guess about, when was Ireland evangelized? About the 400s, the Irish became Christian, and then I'm kind of in direct line from that with my mum. But I guess, so the reason, the better way to answer that is, why am I still a Christian? Because I'm a Christian because monks and stuff bothered to come and evangelize my ancestors. I'm still a Christian because I came to uni and I was keen to abandon and break that line of succession from those early monks. But I got involved in a group like this, which helped me to think more deeply than I had about the Christian faith and to lock in on it as something that was true. Mm. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'm going to hand over to you.
Excellent. Well, I guess in terms of a truth in advertising statement, it's probably worth knowing that there's a logic behind the way the mission has unfolded. And this week, we're kind of bang on the Christian faith. We're talking not so much about topics that do or don't hinder or help people to understand the Christian faith, but about the Christian faith itself. So it's the kind of thing, just heads up, it's the kind of week and the kind of talks that you yourself could decide to become a Christian on the basis of, as in they're designed so that you would know enough, I think, by the end of this week to think, oh, I'm in, and become a Christian. So I just wanted to give you a heads up on that so you don't feel like you're getting hustled on the way through. We're not going to play any music or lock any doors unless by talk five things haven't been going well, and then we kick in with the more coercive stuff. But talks 1 to 4, it's really in your court, and I want you to know that if you feel like you're way back from what we're saying, then feel free to do the circle again and think about those things that are in the way. If you can feel like the path between you and Jesus is fairly clear and you're just wanting to know what would it be like to lock in on it, I think that's where we're driving in these. And it's the kind of, Christianity is the kind of thing you can become. You don't have to be born in it. You don't have to have a mystical experience. It's the kind of thing that you can become a Christian. And these talks are kind of driving in a non-manipulative way toward that. Does that make sense? Good. All right. The last talk in the last hour, which some of you won't have been here for, we started thinking about the Christian hope, about what is it that Christians say is the hope of the world, is the end game of our world. Is there a hope for our world? Is there a hope for human culture? Is there a future for evil and suffering, or does that have an end game? Is there a future for our bodies and our environment? They're the kind of questions that we're on. And in the last talk, we thought about Paul in Athens. So Paul, the Jewish/Christian first century missionary, goes to Athens, the home of rationalism and reason and logic. and defends there his belief that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead, that there's a creator God who's going to bring all things to account. And it wasn't a particularly successful talk for the Apostle Paul. He went there and gave the talk, and at the end of that, he went to the Areopagus on Mars Hill, and all the people listened to him, and it said some people scoffed, some people wanted to hear more about it, kind of joined a group that pursued that, and a few believed. A few heard it and thought, yeah, I could come at that. And to be fair, Paul, that was a difficult environment for Paul to be in, because Paul is in the home of Greek reason and logic and thought, and he's in a world where the Greeks, by and large, saw the world as circular and eternal. And Paul's talking about a world that's linear, that has a beginning and an end, and talking about a world with goals and with a God outside of creation rather than gods within it. And he was talking to people that were in the habit of thinking of bodies as kind of gross and grotty and an impediment to spiritual life. And yet Paul is there saying that there's a future for the body, that God is going to raise up our bodies. And I think for many of the people he talked to, that would just be kind of a horrible zombie kind of future, and they wouldn't like it. And so in terms of just sheer heavy lifting, Paul had his work cut out in front of him in defending the Christian hope in Athens. But in this second talk, in the 22 minutes that I think I've got, I wanted to think about how the Christian hope landed among the Jewish people. What does it mean for Jesus and Paul, themselves Jewish, to start talking about the resurrection of Jesus in the context of what Jewish people believed and what they hoped for and longed for? And you'd think this is an easier task, and it is, but not so much. There's a whole lot of confusion even at this point. I don't know if you watch Futurama. There's a classic kind of early episode of Futurama. I don't know if you know this one. I looked for it this morning on YouTube, but I couldn't find it because the only search words I had were Futurama and humans, and that covers a fair bit of Futurama. But there's an early episode of Futurama where they go, Fry and the gang go to another planet, and on that planet there's a genre of movie which is kind of human-based. So they like, you know, like we make like making movies about humans, or like about zombies. They like making movies about humans. But no one in that planet has seen a human for about like 10 generations. And so their theory on what humans look like is based on ancient memory and folklore and stuff. And the humans, who tend to be baddies in the films, are these kind of slightly pink, like massive elongated figures that only bear the tiniest resemblance to what an actual human looks like. And I think especially if you've kind of grown up in a Western Christianized culture, you assume that the Jewish culture thought things about the life in the age to come and souls and bodies and stuff that is kind of you can see where it's coming from, but a weird kind of elongated distortion of what the Jewish people in the first century, the Jewish people of Jesus and Paul, did actually believe about the hope to come. We sometimes have the impression that the Christian hope is that you go to heaven, and it really isn't. We sometimes give the impression that Christians hope to escape from their bodies and become souls, and we really don't. And Christians sometimes have given the impression that we want to be rescued from this material world, that we want to be redeemed from this world, and we really don't. Because the truth is, we don't believe in the immortality of the soul. And we don't believe in being redeemed from our bodies or abandoning creation. Now, properly understood, we stand in Jewish soil where we look for the resurrection of our bodies, where we look for the redemption of the creation. And that's where Paul and Jesus were standing. I had a privilege actually earlier this year of having a public discussion with a guy called Rabbi Solomon in Perth. And he was a very great man and interesting and informative. And we had in a situation like this, talked about the Christian hope and the Jewish hope and how they're different. And he was sharing, which you may know, and some of you may be Jewish, that at a Jewish funeral, there's almost no kind of redemptive liturgy. There's no point in the liturgy where you say, oh, this is all for the best and things have worked out well here. A Jewish funeral has no flowers, typically. You come dressed in whatever clothes you were wearing at the time. And he said just 2 years ago, he had to bury his dad, and there's nothing sentimental about it. You put the body in the grave with no coffin, and then you start digging and heaving in the dirt. And he said, Rabbi Solomon said in that public discussion, he said, do you know why? Because we Jews hate death. We hate death. We're for life. And he was talking, saying, you Gentiles, like all your funerals are flowers and angels and stuff. He said, we're for life. We hate death. And he's exactly right. He's exactly right that when you look through the Old Testament, A, the Old Testament doesn't have a whole stack to say about life after death. And what it does say about death is always negative, that death is an intruder, it's an enemy. It's not like a cutesy part of the creation that all makes everything flowers and bunny rabbits. It's something that is an enemy. I'll give you some quotes from the Old Testament. In Psalm 6, the poet says, in death there is no remembrance of you. In the grave, who can give you praise? Or Psalm 115, the dead do not praise the Lord, nor do any that go down into silence. Psalm 30, what profit is there in my death if I go down to the pit? Will the dust praise you? Will it tell of your faithfulness? Or the book of Samuel, a storybook, a history book, which says, we must all die. We're like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up. It's pretty brutal stuff. The Old Testament is not rosy. The Jewish scriptures are not rosy about death. Now, as the Old Testament scriptures, as the Jewish scriptures unfold, a tradition does develop in the Psalms and in the book of Daniel and so on, where you glimpse through a tiny crack into some sort of hope of life beyond death, into some sort of consciousness of the faithfulness of God even after death. But it's, you know, a dozen places. Which raises the question, how did the early Christians, all of them Jewish, come to believe in the resurrection of the dead? Come to believe in this great and present and pressing hope that the dead would be raised, that they would be brought to life again, that God had done something in history that was real and true and changed everything for everyone? And I think there are three things about the Jewish soil of the Christian hope that made that, unlike what it was at Athens, a thinkable thought. The first one is the Creator God. It sounds normal to us if you've lived, as I say, in a kind of Western culture, to think of God as a creator. I think the Oxford English Dictionary defines God as a creator. But that was a new idea in the ancient world. It was the Jewish people that proclaimed this idea that there was one God and he created all things. And that the world came about not because of a war between the gods or because of a copulating set of gods or not because there was a monster that was cut in two and destroyed. No, the Jewish people taught that there was a God who created all things. And that God was good and he created a good world, not a world that is the product of a war in heaven. And so the story of the Bible is a human pair, a man and a woman in a garden. And the garden is good, and the man and the woman are good. And the opening scene is this dead body on the ground, the body of Adam. God made it, and then he breathes into it the breath of life, and it stands up. And God says to the man and to the woman that here is my good creation, and you're to bring it to its flourishing, to bring it to its fullness, to creatively engage with the good material world that I've made and make it better, make it sing, make it work. You see, in the Jewish point of view and in the Christian point of view, the material world is good, made by a good God, and humans are made to bear his image within it, to be the image bearers of God in the creation. So the Old Testament scriptures, which don't say much about life after death, say an awful lot about the Creator God who made a good world, a good material world. The second thing they teach is not just the creatorness of God, possibly not a word, but the faithfulness of God. If you read from Genesis to Malachi, if you read the whole Jewish scriptures and you ask, what is the primary characteristic of this God? What's he like? I think the answer would be faithful. That the Jewish people believed in a God who was absolutely determined to keep his promises, that he would never go back on something that he had said. And so the Jewish people came to believe that the promises of God even survived death. That even in our death, if God had promised something to someone, he would make good his promise. God the Creator, God the Faithful, and finally, the story of Israel itself. You know, if you go through the Old Testament and you're looking for explicit references to what happens after you die, and as I say, you get a pretty meager harvest from that. But if you've got eyes to see it, death and resurrection is happening in the Old Testament all the time. Let me tell you a few stories that may be vaguely familiar from our backgrounds. This is the story of Joseph, a la Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. And Joseph is an early Israelite who is thrown into a pit by his brothers. And then he's sent down into Egypt where he's a slave. And then God raises him up and gives him the name that is above all names. Joseph goes down and then he's lifted up. Or the story of Israel itself, the big primary story for Israel that shaped its identity was that it was the nation that had gone down into slavery in Egypt. It had been subjugated by Pharaoh, and that God came in and lifted Israel up and brought it on eagle's wings into the desert and into the promised land. And then ultimately, Israel was the nation that died in exile. There's a point in the history of Israel where the Babylonians come in and smash the town up, and like really smash it up. They set fire to the temple, they desecrate all the sacred altars, they pluck out the eyes of the king after having killed all his sons in front of him. That was their way of saying, it's over, Israel. They destroyed the town, they took Israel into exile. And for 70 years, Israel lived in Babylon, and it was over. There is no future for the nation of Israel. But the whisper starts to go around the exiles to say, the prophets are saying that God's got a plan. The prophets are saying that something's going to happen here. And one of the most famous prophets, Ezekiel, has this reasonably famous vision where there's this valley of dry bones, and the bones are just this, it's in a desert and it's brittle, and there's no, you know, to see bones is the opposite of life, and there's no doctor that sees some bones and thinks, oh, we can do something here. There they are, brittle. And then Ezekiel has this kind of creepy vision that a wind comes through the valley and the bones start to rattle and come together, and they're formed together in anatomically correct arrangements, and then sinews come on and flesh and skin. And then there's a creepy bit, a valley of dead bodies. And then the wind comes and breathes life into them. And this whole kind of zombie army stands up and is alive. And it's God's way of telling Ezekiel that he's going to raise up the nation of Israel. That God is going to pull them out of their death and bring them to life again as a nation. And then you get to the time of Jesus, and all the songs, at least of the underdogs in Israel, are about God doing that. Mary and the others are singing about the time where God's going to come and lift them up and make them a nation again and make them strong and relieve them from their oppression. So you put all that together and you can start to see how it is that the worldview, the circumstances by which you might think that resurrection makes sense. That God created all things and therefore he might have a future for material bodies. That God is faithful and he might keep his promises even beyond the grave. And that God is perpetually in the habit of bringing life from death. Of taking something when it's at rock bottom and bringing it to life again. Well, the Bible story begins in a garden. We talked about that before, Adam and Eve, the body lying on the ground, God breathing life into it and making it stand up. And so as we finish this talk, I want to take you to one more garden. So in this garden, it's early in the morning, it's still dark, the sun has not yet risen. And a young woman goes into that garden and goes to pay her respects to the grave of a loved one. And she comes to the tomb. How creepy is this? It's still dark. It's early in the morning. You get to, I said, a garden, essentially a cemetery garden. And you get there and someone's been messing with the grave of the actual person that you're going to visit. And the tomb has been messed with and the stone has been moved. And she gets there, and I would be freaking out. I can't even like go into a dark church at nighttime. And there you are in a cemetery, and someone is messing with a tomb somewhere while it is dark. What the heck? And so she goes home, which is exactly what I would do. And she says to the people that she's staying with, she says, I was at the tomb, and someone's been messing with it, and I think someone's probably come and taken the body. I think they've taken the body, and I don't know where they've taken it. And the two young men who she went to, they start running toward this garden. And they go to the garden, and there's one that gets there first, but he doesn't go in, younger and faster runner. He goes in, and he looks from the outside, and he sees exactly what the woman said she saw in the garden, namely that there's a tomb, but there's no body in it. And he can see from where he's standing that there's strips of linen in the tomb, the ones that would have covered the body. And the older man is a slower runner, so he arrives a bit later. But he goes right into the tomb, later but braver. And he goes into the tomb and he sees exactly, the story's verified, there's no body, and he sees the linen. But he gets close enough to see that the linen has kind of been folded, and there's the stuff that would have gone around the body and that's folded, and then there's the stuff that would have gone around the head and that's been folded and separate from the body. What sense do you make of a scene like that? The woman was right, the body was gone. And this happened 2,000 years ago, and yet the woman reaches the same conclusion that I think anyone in this room would reach. She doesn't say, there's no body, definitely a miracle. She says, there's no body, someone has taken it. That is the most reasonable, rational conclusion from the scene that you see. But the scene kind of raises some questions. So, for example, why would someone want that body? For a Jewish person, you may come unclean touching bodies like that, and there's not a massive market in the ancient world for body parts and so on. And if you steal a body for I don't know what, why would you, at 3 o'clock in the morning, take the grave clothes off the body? Because how does it help you? You're there with Terry, and you say, Terry, let's take this body, but let's get the clothes off, because it really helps to be running through Jerusalem with a dead, naked body, as opposed to a body that's been wrapped in white linen. And then if you and the other guy that have gone to steal a body and your preference is for naked bodies, are you also going to be like a really neat person that you think, all right, we've got this body and actually this place looks awful. Let's just kind of tidy it up a bit before we go and then off we go. It's a really strange scene. Meanwhile, the woman is out of the tomb in the garden weeping. And a guy comes up to her and he says, why are you crying? Who are you looking for? And she thinks it's the gardener. And she says, did you take the body? Do you know where it is? Tell me. And the gardener says, Mary. And she says, Rabbi. You may have guessed that that story is the story from the Gospel of John of the resurrection of Jesus. They went to the tomb early in the morning. And it's a remarkable account. It's full of weird facts and figures. That one person gets there sooner but doesn't go in. The other one gets there later but does go in. That the way the linen's arranged, the way things are, that a woman gets there first whose testimony wouldn't be received in a first century court. You get the names of the people, Peter, John, and Mary. There's all sorts of reasons, which we'll think about tomorrow, why it's to be taken seriously as history, as purporting to be, in some sense, about something that happened. And in the first talk tomorrow, I want to ask, could you believe it? Is it possible? We'll go a slightly different angle to yesterday as we think about under what circumstances would you find that to be true? But I also want to flag the question, what does it mean? Because, for all that Jewish background, no one in the first century expects a body to be raised in time. There's a strong tradition of resurrection at the end of time. The Pharisees expected that our bodies would be raised and so on. No one expects anyone, even the Messiah, to be raised from the dead. And so in those stories, there's almost no allusions to Old Testament scripture, because we're on new ground here. something unexpected, something weird, and just to ruin the rest of the talk, something really, really good happened on Easter Sunday. And I think you get a bit of a clue, because did you notice you've got a garden, and you've got a man and a woman standing in the garden, because I think the resurrection means that the beginning of the new creation is here already. Thank you for your attention.
Rory, just as you sit down, you want to grab back up again. If you want to ask some questions of Rory, feel free to text them through to the number that's on the screen. Otherwise, you can just chuck your hand up and then we can ask it that way. So, Patty, sorry, are these questions for the first hour? Okay. I don't understand what that question means. Sorry, there's lots of... God doesn't go chronos or kairos.
Yeah, I got that.
He doesn't operate... That's good that you do. He doesn't operate by that rationality like humans do. So is death not then an interpretation of what happened before the completion of eternity and not an actual time of death?
So chronos and kairos is a distinction in two ways of thinking about time in the Greek language.
Yeah.
But this person's saying that God is subject to neither chronos nor kairos,
yeah.
So neither chronological time nor opportune time, and therefore is death kind of also outside of time?
Does the person want to reiterate the question?
Sure. No, respect.
Just stepping out in the deep end there. That's faith. So pretty much what I wanted to say, I don't even go here. How cool is that? Is that if God doesn't operate on time, chronos and kairos, hey, I just learned it this morning in philosophy and
Sweet.
Existentialism. So I want
to. When
like,
you learn
touch
something, the
it.
Trick is to get it into the next conversation as soon as possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
A segue. Perfect.
Yeah.
Is death then just an interpretation that is variable for person to person? So like an interpretation that death doesn't actually mean that that is a time of death, but death is a place that is just a part of life as life is a part of another piece of eternity.
Yeah, thanks. I think that in some ways, I think like on empirical ground, if you were thinking, what's the best way to comprehend death? I think what a lot of religions do, and certainly what a lot of religions do is look for the cycle and to say, actually, I can come to terms with this because I garden and I farm and things die and then the carcass rots, but then new life comes out of that. And so maybe I can come to terms with death by integrating it into a cyclical view of existence. And I think that's like if you kind of picking your top five resolutions for death, that's up there, right? That's a pretty credible way of thinking about it. But for reasons that we'll go into tomorrow, especially tomorrow, that is not the option that the Jewish people and the Christian people chose. Because of the resurrection of Jesus, they believe that death was an alien intruder that God was at loggerheads with rather than sympathetic towards, which is... It's a crazy way of thinking about death, and I would think if not for the resurrection of Jesus, doesn't have a lot of other stuff going for it, except I think our deepest intuitions that when someone gives you permission to say death is an enemy, you think, yeah, actually, it sucks. Actually, I do really hate it, and I really hate what happened to my mom, and I really hate what happened to that person, and I hate being in a universe with death. And empirically, that's not got a lot going for it. But if Jesus did rise from the dead, then something's come online to affirm that intuition that death really sucks. So that's tomorrow. Thanks.
Someone has texted in a question. You said that Jesus' resurrection from the dead was unexpected, yet Jesus raised people from the dead as part of his miracles. What makes Jesus' resurrection any different from theirs?
Yeah, so the weird thing about Jesus' resurrection is that it's unlike what we could distinguish for the sake of things as resuscitations, which happen, you know, half a dozen times in the Bible, where people come back to life in exactly the form that they died, in some of them almost to an absurd degree, like in John's Gospel where Lazarus comes out in the tomb clothes with them all kind of falling off him a la cartoons. And people see that and people think it happened, like the people who are witnesses of it think it happened, but no one thinks this is a new thing. They think this is a miracle. But there's something about the resurrection of Jesus where people conclude that he has been raised to new life rather than just resuscitated back to life. That there's something about his appearance and the way they interact with him. They think this is something that we were expecting at the end of time that's been drawn back into our present experience. I think that's probably the difference.
Someone has asked, why is the new creation good? And what did you mean? And another person asked, what do you mean by the new creation is now here?
So by the new creation is now here, I think that the people that witnessed the resurrection had a timetable which said that God was going to bring justice, was going to raise up and redeem us and the universe, and the new creation is here in the sense that God has sent something unexpectedly back in time to our reality rather than leaving it all at the end of time. And that's how the New Testament writers comprehend the resurrection of Jesus. They think we live in a period where not everything has happened, but not nothing has happened, because something's happened. So the Jewish people lived in hope that the world would be redeemed, and that was taken on trust, that God said it, and you say, okay, everything in my experience seems to indicate otherwise, but I'll trust you, whereas now a thing has happened in history that is a pledge and token of the new creation. And that'll be especially talk six.
And someone has asked, so are we to conclude that Christians believe that our whole body will be resurrected or just our soul?
Whole body. Talk five.
Hang out for it. Someone has asked, in John, the Gospel of John, Mary says that someone took the body. But in other Gospels, Mark and Matthew, an angel appears to them. Wouldn't Mary talk about the angel to the others?
Yeah, so in general, one of the things about the accounts of the resurrection of Jesus that make historians enthusiastic and Christians slightly squirmish is that they do fit awkwardly against each other. So again, two bits of truth in advertising, we'd love you to become a Christian, and they're a bit awkward. So in the sense that they historians like that because they're not collaborative evidence. They don't read like a bunch of people who said, oh, I don't want to look like an idiot. I'm going to say angel. You're going to say, you're not going to mention the angel. Let's both have an angel so it all looks better. They are awkward. I'm not sure that there's anything that's impossible in the sense that A and non-A are both the same thing, or that there's an unmarried, there's a bachelor who's also married. But it's a bit of a thing to try to make them all fit together. I think, we'll talk about that in talk three, which is the first one tomorrow.
Someone asks, what if Jesus had died on the cross but had never been raised again?
Then we, above all people, should be pitied. If that's true, then you should start a charity that helps the EU wean themselves off this awful delusion and waste of time.
And why?
Talk four.
Cool. Someone has asked, anyone wants to set up a charity? Feel free. What happened between the time that Jesus died and rose again?
I don't know. There's a Christian creed that says he descended into hell. But there's kind of ambiguities, would you believe, about even what that means. I can only think of one place that may give you some indication of what Jesus was doing between his death and resurrection. So sorry, I'm agnostic on that. Mm.
Someone's asked to know the relationship between the inbreaking of the new creation and the resurrection and how that relates to the new creation that we see in Revelation 21.
Yeah, so I think say in Revelation 21, which is the last book of the Bible, it's got this massive vision of the new creation in Revelation 21 and 22. And I think I don't know exactly how it relates, but in the sense that some of that stuff has spilled backwards into our world. So for example, the Apostle Paul says that if anyone is in Christ, there is the new creation. So there's one example that by being in Christ, you somehow participate in what the book of Revelation talks about with the redemption of all creation now in him, which again, they'll be like, we'll talk about that again.
Does anyone have any more questions? Cool. How about you thank Rory with me?